Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, my coverage of the 49th Toronto International Film Festival continues. Today, a spotlight on two trans films. The award-winning trans short, Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think You Might Fail? And the Canadian trans feature, Really Happy Someday. All that and more on episode 424, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on two trans films that were part of this year's Toronto International Film Festival. Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think You Might Fail? That film won TIFF's Best Canadian Short. Director Beck Pico joins me to talk about what went into making this award-winning film. Plus, the Canadian trans feature, Really Happy Someday. A film that follows a rising music theater star before his transition that has to figure out how to sing in his new register in order to return to the thing that he loves most and, in the process, integrate his past and present selves. The film's director, Jay Stevens, and the film's star, Breton LaLama, join me to talk about Really Happy Someday. And in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, and on this episode I'm featuring some classic disco, some queer indie, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 424 through Rainbow Country, and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. On this episode, award-winning writer Paige Mailot reads from her memoir, My Body is Distant, a book that tells the author's trans journey to self-realization. By the way, on goodreads.com, My Body is Distant has a rating of 4.3 out of 5 stars.
Memory is a slippery and selective thing. To provide an example, think back to your earliest memory. One of mine was a hot summer day in 1979. I would have been 4 years old and my sister Lana only 2. The memory begins with us running barefoot across cool, shaded grass behind the turn of the century schoolhouse our father skillfully converted into our childhood home. As I ran and Lana chased after me, grasshoppers sprang from the grass, cicadas screeched in the trees, and the neighbors' cows grazed in fields on the other side of the electrified fences which surrounded our property. Already, I have fabricated details to draw you into my story. While I know there were often cows in the fields which surrounded our house, and that cicadas often screeched in the trees, I don't remember how warm it really was. And I can't recall whether cicadas were out or if there were cows nearby that day. I have only included these pseudo-facts to pave the way to a moment that stuck with and still shapes who I am some 40-something years later. I remember we found ourselves in the sun-warmed, wood-scented back shed where we discovered my father's tackle box. We pried open squeaky metal clasps, and inside we found the most incredible fishing lures. To our inexperienced eyes, they looked uncannily like actual fish, with shining scales drawn with metallic paints and gleaming bright eyes. Some were hinged in the middle to mimic realistic swimming, I assume. Lana grabbed as many fish as she could, somehow avoiding hooking herself. She looked up at me, her body vibrating with excitement as she said, "Let's see them swim." I agreed and gathered the rest. We ran out of the shed and across the lawn holding handfuls of jingling fish. I followed Lana to a deep circular pond ringed with flagstones, which my father had dug in the middle of our yard. Lana wasted no time as she climbed the stones and threw her handfuls into the water. When they struck the surface, years of dust splashed away and the lures came to life. The tiny fishes twisted and flipped just below the surface. Their chromatic scales flashed in a dizzying rainbow of colors before they sank. Each twinkled in the sunlight one last time, as if giving thanks, before they disappeared into the murky depths of the pond. "Did you see that?" Lana asked. "Throw yours." I recognized the potential consequences of tossing away my father's prized fishing lures, but I couldn't help myself. I wanted to see those colors. I needed to see if they truly could come to life again. I tossed mine, alone and in twos, at Lana's impatient urgings. We watched with amazement as they rolled and flashed in the murky water as they sank, leaving us with vivid memories and regret. For me, memory is a lot like my fish story. I only seem to remember moments which particularly delight or trouble me, and sometimes the ones that flash brightest are the ones that do both. I like to think my brightest memories are also the ones which have taught me valuable lessons, like how throwing away antique heirloom fishing lures can make your father cry. This memoir is, therefore, imperfect. It will contain details as true as I can remember them, and I'm certain some recollections will be incorrect or incomplete. All I can promise is that the memories in these pages are, to the best of my knowledge, influential moments of my life which have shaped me into the woman I am today. I hope you graciously accept that possibility as I recall these stories with you. By reading them, you can cause these memories to flash and sparkle once more. While not every recollection in this memoir shines, I believe it is important to include the difficult parts and the ones that beacon on regrettable decisions. Because if we don't record these multicolored memories as accurately as possible, they might sink into the darkness and be lost forever. 2010. Another 11 years later, in an abandoned amusement park. Emerging from a cloud of rose-scented mist, Callie's face is lit electric pink as we pass a buzzing neon heart on the tunnel's rocky wall. We float together in a giant rubber duck that pulls us along a submerged track toward an expanding arch of light. As we pass through the cave's mouth, sunlight gleams off the duck's droplet-sprinkled plastic wings, and the sequined lining of my bridal gown reflects shimmering rainbows across the water's surface. Callie caresses my ears. What did you think? Best honeymoon ever, I say. We're only getting started. A sly smirk hints at the corner of Callie's mouth as he pulls me close. I rest my cheek against his suit-covered chest, allowing myself to melt into the relaxing vibration of his affectionate purring. Being here, having him holding me, sharing this moment together in an actual tunnel of love with my husband, has made all the fuss of the past 2 weeks of wedding mayhem worthwhile. This does truly feel perfect, even though I know that none of this is real. Not in the way most people value realness. I know this amusement park we're in, this plastic duck boat, and even our avatars are just lines of code stored on a softly humming server somewhere. Despite that, I feel an authentic bond with Callie, which is no less valid than the intimacy and trust that accompanies sharing your bed and life with someone in the real world. In loving relationships, we seek reassurances that our partner cares for us. Grand romantic gestures may be beautiful and sweep you off your feet, but they're easily staged. We communicate true love through a multitude of selfless moments. Love appears as an unprompted cup of tea, just the way you like it on a tough day. Or when you fawn over a beautiful sweater and a week later, it appears on the dining room table, even when it's not your birthday. Genuine gestures of love can even appear in an act as simple as being cuddled as the little spoon while you drift off to sleep. Despite what you might think, these gestures can mean more online. Callie's wedding suit is an excellent example. If he and I married in real life, he might buy or rent a suit. A tailor then measures and makes alterations, but all Callie has done is point and pay and pick it up when he's ready. Here, Callie inevitably tried on multiple suits from multiple online vendors, still spent real money to buy it, but then he also sank hours in an editor, carefully tweaking the suit's proportions to accommodate his unique furry body. It took me 3 days to find and fit a bridal dress that showed my tail and then edit a veil so that it didn't cut off my ears. Callie proposed with an emerald ring. While he likely didn't spend too much to buy it, he took the time to learn I preferred emeralds to diamonds. Communication and attention to detail mattered just as much here. He also scouted this abandoned amusement park for us to be alone. Thoughtful kindnesses like these are more than I've ever experienced in a real-life relationship. In some ways, online relationships better illustrate commitment and desire. In real life, you and I might walk together. Your hand might bump mine, and we might like the feeling of accidental touch enough to hold hands. It could be sweet, but there's a casualness to this act that cannot occur online. In virtual worlds, we might similarly walk together, but you would intentionally position your character closer to mine, target me, and initiate a command like, slash hold hands with Lydia. While stepping out of a romantic moment to type may sound detached, if my online partner values the time required to specifically write an affectionate gesture just because they want to build a connection, doesn't that add something? Describing a character's intention is not only precise and deliberate, but every descriptive pose my partner writes is only for me, for us, to create our memorable moment. Whether we're holding hands or fighting or fucking, we craft line after line of descriptive prose, a conscious, poetic rededication to the value of our relationship. So, yes. I know that our relationship, our marriage and this moment are not real in the way society might define it, but for a lonely and sick trans woman, they're everything. Besides, don't scientists say reality as we understand it might be lines of code anyway?
When I return, really happy someday.
Hi, I'm Keegan Hurst, former professional rugby player, coach, raving homosexual, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tarr.
Jay Stevens, hi, how are you?
Hi, Mark. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am well. Breton LaLama, hello.
Yes. Hello, Mark. How's it going?
It's gone.
Absolutely
gone. It's gone. Yeah.
That's all I will say. The two of you have a feature at the 49th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. I'm asking everyone the same first question. How has your TIFF experience been so far, Jay?
Oh, it's been, I keep saying it's like a wild roller coaster, but it's the best roller coaster I've ever been on. Like, I feel like you're going all over the place all the time. There's so much happening, so much amazing stuff happening, but it's been unbelievable and so great to finally get to bring this film out into the world. It was our world premiere on Sunday. And so, yeah, to actually get to hear an audience reaction and see an audience reaction has been really, really special.
And Breton, for yourself, how has this experience been for you?
Can it be a sound as an answer?
Sure.
It's been wild. Same thing that Jay said around reception and getting to feel people feeling the film. It's been rather sleepless. yeah. Very grateful.
So really happy someday. This is your film. Jay, you direct this film. You co-wrote this film. I believe you were even the cinematographer for this film. Talk to me about the story that you're telling in Really Happy Someday.
Really Happy Someday follows Z, who was a rising musical theater star before he started testosterone. And so when we begin the film, Z has been on testosterone for about 9 months to a year and has lost control of his singing voice, which up until this point in his life and his career was kind of the only thing he ever trusted and felt at home in. And so we follow Z. It's a narrative film, but we follow Z throughout the course of a year, which we did shoot over the course of a year, to in the fight to get control of his voice and his life back. And it's a very much like slice of life drama about what it means to fight to be the authentic version of yourself.
So Breton, you star in this film, you co-wrote this film, you play the character of Z. Essentially, who is Z, and is Z you?
Who is Z? Who is anyone? No. Z is, as Jay said, or was, a rising musical theater star. And yeah, he's been on TV about 9 months, and that's a really tricky time in the vocal transition of a trans guy. So you don't really have a lot of range. And that's specifically because, unlike cisgendered, people going through puberty, cisgendered males going through puberty, when you are an adult, an adult assigned female at birth person starting HRT, you go through the same kind of vocal puberty, but you lack growth hormones. So your vocal cords just thicken and they don't lengthen. So it comes with all these really tricky, nuanced changes that there's not a lot of research yet at this time about. And he's navigating that. He is troubled. He is kind of isolated, even though he's really surrounded by community. And he's just really struggling to find out what it means to be a person in the world, which I think is something that anyone can relate to as he goes through these really big life changes. Z is not me. Z is kind of like an amalgamation of parts of Jay and myself, because we wrote it together, right? And I would say he is not either of us either, but he definitely pulls from little pockets or little attributes of our own lived experiences.
So Jay, yourself and Breton co-wrote this film. Was there a moment, was there a flashpoint, was there a point where one of you or the two of you said, let's tell this story? Was there that moment, Jay?
Yeah, it happened before we started the film. I think I've said this a few times, but I was trying to write a different film for a couple of years, and it had very similar themes. I wanted it to be slice of life. I wanted it to be shot over time. But I never wanted to send the script to people. I just wasn't happy with what it was saying. And then one lovely, faithful day, Breton and I had been following each other on Instagram for a little while. And one day we were in a part of the city we're never normally in, and I was crossing the street, and this person pulled up on their bike, and it was like, Breton? And he was like, Jay? And we spoke for probably like 45 seconds, and I just left that conversation being like, Breton's a sparkly human. Like, there's something there that, I don't know, I feel drawn to his energy. And that day happened to be his 1 year on testosterone anniversary. And so that night he posted like 50 to 100 Instagram stories about his vocal transition, because Breton is a performer, has done musical theater, and so documented the process within himself quite thoroughly, and was doing like an Ask Me Anything. And I just was watching those stories, one, so grateful for Breton being an open book in terms of putting that onto Instagram for folks to see and witness, but also just going like, oh, this is a nuanced version of, I think, the story I've been trying to tell, and a story that I've never seen told. And it was so specific, but obviously the fight to find your voice, to be authentic in the world, I think is so universal. And so it kind of felt right instantly. Like, instantly in that moment I was like, oh, this feels like it. And then just reached out to Breton on Instagram the next day, and I said, hi, this is wild because we met for 45 seconds, but is there any chance that you would want to co-write and act in a feature with me? And I think, yeah, the process never felt hard, like, from that point on. It's not to say there weren't challenges, but it never felt draining in any way. It felt very like filling your cup versus the opposite. Mm.
So Breton, your character of Z is a music theater performer. There are scenes in the movie where your character Z goes to their vocal coach for singing lessons. For you as a performer, for you as an actor, what was it like for you to play those scenes? Because you had to be pretty vulnerable and have your voice crack and all that sort of stuff, which as vocalists you don't necessarily want out there. So how was it for you as an actor to play those scenes?
Yeah, that's actually, thanks for acknowledging that, Mark. I appreciate that. Oh my gosh, it was terrifying. I mean, I keep saying, yeah, literally, right? I can't sing. Actually, Jay recently reminded me of, in the writing of it, because we wrote over time, because we shot over time to make sure we could authentically capture the journey. I had wanted to be further along than I was in my transition. And I sent Jay a voice note kind of freaking out, being like, I can't sing it like this yet. So we have to, I don't know how I'm going to do this next block of shooting. And because they are the compassionate person and director that they are, they said, well, then I think we have to put that in the movie. So I share that story because, yeah, it was terrifying. And that was a lot of the time being like, what am I doing? But I think the point was that Jay cultivated a kind of working space that was so supportive and so grounded in the present that I, though I was, you know, having all the feels about even just singing in front of people, like our small four-person crew, or so sometimes maybe less than that, I wasn't thinking about like, oh God, when this comes out in the world. Like, I never had any expectation that this would be at TIFF or anywhere, you know. I was really just thinking about singing in that moment. So it was scary, but it didn't feel so so public, because it was simply, we were just, I was just Z with my vocal teacher, and the vocal teacher in the movie is my real life vocal teacher. So I think that kind of also grounded it in the present for me, that kind of getting to lean into that relationship that me and her have as real people, as a sort of backbone to the to the acting of it. Yeah. And I think, you know, ultimately, as Jay reminds me as I panic now, especially because my voice has continued to change, is in, thank goodness, and is in a very different place now, a more capable place than it was during shooting. And yeah, like you said, I do get, I do have these moments of like, oh God, everyone's going to think that's it. And Jay reminds me, you know, the reason we made this is so that people who are in that moment of deep struggle and fear around losing their voice, or maybe even starting HRT because of fears of what it'll do to their voice, can see this and remember and know, rather, that it's part of it and that they're not alone in that. So that's helpful to my little ego fits as well.
So I just have a handful of minutes left with the two of you. And my last question to the two of you is simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Really Happy Someday? Jay, let's start with yourself.
I hope that audiences take away the power of when what is behind the camera mirrors or reflects what's in front of it. We were extremely intentional, from our crew members to all of the incredible musicians you hear on our soundtrack, to the folks writing the score, with who we were putting those positions. And I hope they take away being like, wow, there was an authenticity to that that I think people keep equating to it feeling like a doc, but I think what they're actually seeing is like the truth on screen in a way that we rarely get to see as trans folks represented. And then I hope they go, oh my gosh, these artists are incredible. Like, I should hire these musicians. I should hire these folks who are on this set, because they're incredible.
And Breton?
Yeah, I would really echo that. I hope that they realize that what they're feeling comes from exactly what Jay said, is testament to, rather, like the power of not being the only in a space. When we put minorities into the position of majority in creation, in the telling of their own stories, just how honestly powerful and joyful that can be for audiences and for the people involved in making it. Yeah.
That's the joy. Yes.
Well, I have to say, well said, Jay, Breton, well said, well done, well filmed. Congrats. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Mark.
Really Happy Someday is currently doing the film festival circuit. For more information, simply visit spindlefilms.ca.
Hi, everyone. This is Mark Tewksbury, Olympic champion, leader, humanitarian. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Carol B., the host and producer of radio programs Ruby Slippers and through the looking glass. In many parts of the world, one will be excluded or even persecuted just for being gay. And so it's so very important to have a program like Rainbow Country, whose mandate is to provide a platform for the LGBT community to have a voice, share ideas, and promote inclusiveness. Through thought-provoking interviews, preview of cultural events, and music, your host and producer, Mark Tara, showcases the very best the LGBT community has to offer. Rainbow Country, 2 hours well spent.
In June 2014, I was fortunate enough to cover North America's first World Pride that took place in Toronto. The interviews and footage that I captured was recently turned into a documentary that's officially out now. A Different Kind of Love is the name of the documentary and can be found on OutTV and OutTV Proud, which is available on Apple TV and other streaming platforms. So, as you may know, in June, I won the Out Loud Best in LGBT Radio Programming from the NCRA, the National Community Radio Association. I received that honor for my episode on Operation Soap, the bathhouse raids that happened on February 5th, 1981. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond, available on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as an edited podcast, if you think what I'm doing here is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you're listening to the edited podcast, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry Rainbow Country. How can you find out? Well, it's simple. Simply head over to marktara.com where everything is connected and hit the donation banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that carry Rainbow Country. A little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support be heard. Coming up next, are you scared to be yourself because you think you might fail?
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joey Lamar, best-selling author of Mambo Lips and Salsa Hips, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Are you okay? I'm like really nervous. Are you nervous?
No.
You smell crazy.
Oh my God. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so weird. I had no idea what I was going to look like.
What do you think I'm going to look like?
Just like no goose.
They'll be back tomorrow.
I want to go home. Just for like a few days.
A few days?
I can't do nothing with my T-Rex arms. You know, who really wants to help? Your mom wants to help.
Beck Pico, hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am good. We are here on location during TIFF 2024. It's the 49th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. You have a film that's part of the festival, a short. First of all, how has your TIFF experience been so far?
So far, it's been great. I mean, I've only seen 3 films, but because I'm working during the day, so I have to only go at night. But yeah, you know, it's I try to get to TIFF every year, so, and I try to see as many films as I can. And I just kind of let go and see what comes my way, you know. And sometimes you're like, that was amazing. And sometimes you're like, I don't know what I just saw, but but both are interesting experiences.
But you are part of the festival officially, so has it changed for you compared to other years you've been here?
Well, yeah, now I have a little card around my neck, okay, which I'm proud of,
okay,
but still just a guest pass. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone says that, but this is like a total dream of mine because I've been coming to the festival since I was a kid, growing up in Toronto, and I've always, like, yeah, when I was like 12 years old, I was like, I want to have film at Toronto Film Festival, and I had submitted films before, so, you know, it feels like a big deal for me, but it's also a bit surreal because it also just feels like TIFF.
And 2024 mm-hmm. is your year, so you have a short film. And it's called, Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail?
Yes.
That's the title.
Yes.
Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail? You wrote this. You directed this. It's a short, about 20 minutes, a shy of 20 minutes.
Yeah, 17.
First of all, the title.
Yes.
This title. There has to be a story behind this title. What is it?
Well, you know, it actually came from a journal entry that I wrote a long time ago, and it was just that. It was just one page that said that, and I don't even remember writing it, but it is something that I've come back to a lot, and we were going to name it something like really short, and I was like, to my producing partner, Emily Harris, I was like, hear me out. What do you think about a title that's longer than the film? And we both kind of thought that it touched on the nebulous kind of quality that the film is exploring of, like, that, like, we try so hard to find who we are, and it takes so long, and it never stops. So the idea that you could, like, fail at being yourself is kind of funny, but that's, I feel like, what anxiety is, right? Is that, like, when we're not living by our values or living up to our expectations of ourselves, that we feel like we're failing, but really the reality is you are yourself in every moment, whether or not you're showing up the way you want to. So it's not really something you can fail at, but I think that idea of anxiety being like failing at just becoming is was interesting to me.
So essentially, what's the story that you're telling in your film?
Like, in a physical realm, it's really about a person who is recovering from top surgery. So the film starts with them just leaving surgery and getting picked up by their mom and their partner, and they're back in their childhood home recovering, and with their mom and their partner taking care of them. And I really wanted to explore, I guess, on the more like metaphorical level of like, when you're so excited for an experience, I think like as a trans person, it's really a privilege to get gender affirming care, and you're waiting for your name to get called, and you're, you know, waiting for your surgeon, and you're reading everything about it. And it actually is really fucked up, because then you get cut open So it's like, who is excited to get cut open? It changes, right? Like, I think the experience of wanting something and then getting it when it's so, it's such an intense bodily experience. It's really about the character kind of coming down from the excitement of the idea of it and dealing with the reality of, like, it takes a long time to heal.
What I found really interesting was something that I'd never thought of before, but one of our senses, smell, because some of the characters keep referring to that.
Yes.
And I'd never thought of that before. Yeah. Okay, so this story, is it autobiographical? Is it fictional? Is it, you know, based from friends' stories?
It's like, I'd say like most of my work is like creative nonfiction, so it was based on my experience of getting top surgery in May of 2022.
For yourself?
Yeah, for myself. And it, yeah, I think when I got it, I was like really confused because it's a lot more, you know, this is something in the past 5 years that is like now people understand what top surgery refers to versus like a double mastectomy, just in terms of like trans visibility and terminology is so much more commonplace. But there's still a pretty limited amount of like conversations about what the reality of these things are. Like, I found like most of my anxieties went to Reddit forums, you know, like not surgeon websites. And yeah, I struggled in the aftermath. And at the time I was having a more complicated relationship with my mom, but now we're, you know, very close, and we always have been close. But I think that transitioning in front of people is very vulnerable, and it feels really hard to be witnessed when you're not ready yet. You're still like, even though you've had the surgery, it feels like it's going to be a long road. Like, you know,
when you were going through that experience for yourself, did you think, you know, there's something in here, I'm going to use this at some point for my art?
I think in the first week, which is what the film really chronicles, I did not think about that. I was very, it all felt like this super nebulous, like murky kind of time where like days bled into night and you're not really pretty immobile. So
because you're recovering.
You're recovering, yeah. Exactly. And it's something you're like, oh, well, I'm just going to watch TV, read books and stuff. But it's quite anxiety inducing to not be able to do things for yourself and to be reliant on other people. And I think it was kind of more like later in the month as I was recovering, I started to realize like how my dependence on these two relationships of like my chosen like queer partner and family and then like my mom, like how uncomfortable it was. Like, I wanted help, but I didn't want to be seen as like helpless. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhere like later when I was kind of reflecting on the really anxious time that I'd had, because, you know, there's fictional events in the film, like that kind of,
there's a scene outside, yeah, when the character is sitting outside, mm-hmm, and hearing all the neighborhood kids and, yeah, the noises and all that sort of stuff. That scene to me was so, for me, it was profound, because, you know, here's this person just sort of like, you know, outside breathing fresh air and just like, I mean, to me, this is how I read that scene.
Yeah.
And just was like, kind of like just listening and I'm hearing these, you know, these kids just like say whatever. And it's, yeah, like, it was interesting. It was, yeah, really interesting. Is this short a proof of? Is it part of a bigger project?
It actually isn't. It's, I just was like, I want to make something. And it, I mean, I
is
think
it's a standalone.
It's a standalone. Okay. Yeah. I think it speaks to like films I want to make in the future about kind of like, you know, I really want to make a film with a trans person that's not just them in queer community, which is, mm-hmm, can be like a echo chamber in a great way, mm-hmm, where you feel, mm-hmm, supported, mm-hmm, and seen. But like, what's it like to be put back in familial spaces, mm-hmm, that feel uncomfortable?
You're just a person who happens, yes, to be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, that having that character of the mom and her, you know, she doesn't mean to like fuck up their pronouns and stuff. Like, she's just learning. It's just a new thing for her. And having them have to trust her at the end, and take them outside, like, I thought that for me it was kind of like that release of control, where, and also just, yeah, like, go outside. Like, what does it say? Like, internet speak is like touch go touch grass, like when people are like way too in something. Okay. Like when it's like, why are you dissecting this to hell? Like, go outside and like remember that we're like small in like this big environment. And I think that can be really humbling in the best way.
So you are a screenwriter, you're a director, a filmmaker. You went to school for filmmaking. When did you, was there a flashpoint? Was there a moment, maybe even a film that inspired you where you said, this is what I want to do. I'm going to be a filmmaker. Was there anything like that, a flashpoint for you?
Yeah, it's like kind of funny to think of now, but it kind of makes sense too. I probably recognized something early on, but when I saw Juno when I was like, I think 12 or 13, I went with the theater with my dad, and we went to, I'm not sure if this theater exists anymore, but I used to call it the adult movie theater, because, which now sounds like pornographic, but really what it was that my parents would take me to a like, theater in Yorkville that like always, like I remember seeing The Hours when I was like 9 years old, like with Nicole Kidman, and I was like, this is way too advanced for me. But then just like serious films we would go see there, and my dad took me to see Juno, and I was like, holy shit, like I want to make something like that, like something that felt like very familiar and nothing like you'd ever seen before, and also just like a distinct voice. And like mining more complicated relationships and dynamics. Mm-hmm. I thought that there was something, it was just so unique to me.
So that's what did it for you?
Yeah, weirdly, I was like, I'm totally obsessed with that movie.
So, Rainbow Country, it's a gay show. Mm-hmm. I'm gay. Shocker, I know. But for me, I am androgynous. I'm a mix of male, female energy. You use they, them pronouns. For yourself, are you gender non-binary? Are you trans? Where do you fit on that?
I identify as non-binary, but I mean, I started testosterone like 7 months ago, which was like a very big decision for me. Top surgery was no question. I was like, I can't wait to get rid of these things. But I was like, I don't know. It's, for me, gender has been a very big like discovery process. And
When did that start for you then? When did you start, you know, questioning things about yourself?
Well, I came out as a lesbian in college. You know, at NYU there's like a saying that's gay by May, and okay. I was actually late to that because I came out in second year. But it's like, it makes sense and it's true, and so that was like comfortable for me for a long time, and things started, I mean, you know, I felt really repressed as a kid because I think I always knew I was gay. And, you know, it's not a very unique story, but just that feeling of like, oh, I don't know what, I cannot picture myself as an adult. Like, I can't picture what I'm going to look like or do or anything, because I just didn't see anyone who looked like me or wanted what I wanted. And, or if I did see them, it didn't feel attainable to me. But being trans was much more of a, I wouldn't say like a surprise, but I think it was a much deeper impulse that like kind of started to emerge as I started to see people close to me finding their identities. And I was like, wait, we can do that? Or like, I can do that too? Like, I think just like there's such a childhood kind of thing around being allowed to do something, and that like has stayed with me far too long, where I'm like, whose permission do I need to be yourself, you know?
So in regards to your journey, how far along are you in your journey?
I really don't know. Mm. I mean, I guess I came out as non-binary first year of COVID, very classic, you know, we're all kind of looking at the internet and being like, looking at ourselves and seeing what are we...
And then you started testosterone, you said,
last
7 months.
February. Okay. Yeah. So it's been, yeah, it's, and I wouldn't be surprised if I ended up identifying as he, him, but it's always just like, for identification has felt more like, pronouns has always felt like more for other people. Cause I kind of feel probably a bit more like you where it's like, I don't embody the like masculine profile and I don't embody the feminine profile. I kind of call myself like a personality with legs. Okay. Yeah. So really it's just like I'm starting to look how I want to look and however people perceive me, I'm trying not to put too much stock in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what feels good to me.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Here's my last question for you. When audiences see, whether they see this particular short of yours or something in the future, when people see one of your films, what do you hope your audiences come away with? What would you like them to take away from your work?
I would like them to learn and feel, I guess, is that all human experiences are collaborative, including transition. So, you know, I think that seeing that like, there's no good and bad in people, but really just people trying to do their best or their worst, but whatever it is that it's just, I want like to really point to the nuance and three-dimensionality of people. Yeah, I guess that kind of thing.
Well said, well said. Yeah. Beck Pico, thank you for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Thanks for being on the show.
Okay, yeah, thanks for having me.
Are you okay? I'm like really nervous. Are you nervous?
No.
You smell crazy.
Oh my God. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Oh, so weird. I had no idea what I was going to look like.
What do you think I'm going to look like?
Just like no boobs.
They'll be back tomorrow.
I want to go home, just for like a few days.
A few days?
I can't do nothing with my T-Rex arms.
You know, who really wants to help?
Your mom wants to help.
Are you scared to be yourself because you think you might fail? Won the Best Canadian Short at this year's Toronto International Film Festival. For more information, simply visit BeckPico.com.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
I'm Sky Gilbert, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, I'll Tumble For You, Culture Club.
Students, have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, At the Best University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit atthebestu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Hi, this is Police Constable Danielle Botno, also known as LGBT Cop, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.